You again.
Speak up.
You're listening to Speak Up on CJSF 90.1 FM Burnaby. We're the campus and community radio station at Simon Fraser University, where we broadcast from unceded Coast Salish territories.
Good morning, everyone. This is Danny Nesvedarani, your host for this hour of Speak Up, only on CJSF 90.1 FM. We've got a great episode of a bit of talk, a bit of music here for you all this morning. It's a beautiful Tuesday morning. And to start off, before we get into any of the interviews that we have planned for this hour, which, by the way, include a interview with Autumn of Collective Disorder in about 30 minutes, so make sure you stay tuned for that. But before then, let's play some music. This is I'll Follow by Computer.
Expectations.
Once again, that was I'll Follow by the band Computer, local to Vancouver. And coming up next, we have an interview I did with SFU Biological Sciences professor Michael Price. Reporting from Burnaby, BC, this is Danny Nesvedarani, your community journalist for CJSF 90.1 FM. A recently released study from the Canadian Journal of Fisheries and Aquatic Sciences has identified a stark decrease in the monitoring of Pacific salmon populations over the past two decades. According to the study, this erosion in population data greatly decreases the ability of scientists to determine the status of close to half of Pacific salmon populations. To learn more about the implications of this monitoring decrease, as well as why it's been occurring, we spoke with Michael Price, adjunct professor of biological sciences at Simon Fraser University and co-author of this recent study. Please take a listen.
Well, this short abstract of it, without getting too much into the weeds, 2025, when we performed the research, it was the 20th anniversary of a groundbreaking policy of the Department of Fisheries and Oceans, Canada. They adopted what's known as the Wild Salmon Policy. So in 2005, this was initiated, and it was a new direction for salmon conservation. The conservation of salmon was seen as the highest priority above all other users, First Nations, recreation fishers, commercial fishing. It's conservation first and foremost. And then if there's an abundance of salmon, it goes down the line. So anyway, this was a transformative approach for Canada. And again, this being the 20th anniversary, it was trying to assess, well, how are salmon better off? How are we doing when it comes to adhering to the policy? And one of the primary pillars of the wild salmon policy is to assess the health of wild salmon populations. So we wanted to know, are we gathering the necessary information to assess the health of salmon populations? And that those fundamental data, or the fundamental information really, are the annual counts of salmon returning to spawning streams throughout British Columbia and the Yukon. So this is for Pacific salmon, Western Canada. That was the nuts and bolts of it. Here we are 20 years later. Are we better off? Are we acquiring the necessary information? Have we improved over the last 20 years in terms of the amount of information we're gathering on salmon to assess their health? And in doing so, if we assess them as being at risk, then we can make informed decisions of how to turn the tide, how to improve the state for salmon. So that was the context for this work.
What were the, I guess, specific findings of the research in particular? I noticed that like one major thing that was brought up was this, what is being seen as a decline in monitoring regarding local salmon populations.
So over these last 20 years, yes, so we took it a step further. We looked at, how many spawning populations do we have annual estimates for, annual counts of the number of fish returning to these populations. And then how does that translate into how many populations can we assess their health? And we used a specific index like each generation, say, of time, and how that's changed. So we can say that the amount of information we're gathering on salmon has declined by roughly a third over the last 20 years. It's been declining steeply since the mid-1980s. So we're now at essentially the lowest level ever. Since 1950, we're now counting the least number of spawning populations than we really ever have. And how that translates to how many populations can we today assess the health of? And the answer is roughly 50%. or 55%. So we can only really tell the health of half of British Columbia and Yukon's populations. Those are the major findings. So for the other 50%, we have no idea, really, not necessarily for all of them, but for some of them, we don't even know if they continue to exist. We're no longer looking. That's the most worrying. The next level up from that is we don't know if those populations that we no longer have information for, are they declining? Are they at risk? And on the flip side of that is, might some of these be healthy, but because we don't know that they're healthy, there may be fishing opportunities that are no longer there out of an abundance of caution. So it kind of works two ways. In one way, if we don't have the information, we might be making fisheries decisions in the dark. We may be saying, yes, go ahead, go fishing out in the ocean, and we may be impacting populations that can't withstand those fisheries. But on the flip side of that is we may be saying, don't go fishing because we don't have any information, where actually they may be able to sustain some fishing pressure. So it works two ways. And then third, I'll just finish with saying, and this kind of relates to what's happening today, you know, the federal government is now fast-tracking industrial projects, and several of those industrial projects slated for fast-tracking occur in northern watersheds like the Skeena. So at the, you know, the time that we're trying to bring some industrial projects to fruition, whether these are pipelines or transmission projects or mining projects, we're losing our ability to assess whether these projects will actually harm salmon or not. So we're essentially making a lot of decisions in the dark, and that does not bode well for salmon.
Why do you think that this has been occurring? Like, what has led to this decrease in monitoring and tracking of Western salmon populations?
Largely, I would say it's a lack of priority. So it's not because of lack of funding. And we can see that because in 2021, the federal government injected almost $700 million new money into a specific initiative for salmon conservation. And the activities that they've undertaken over the last 5 years, they basically spent all the money, $700 million. Salmon monitoring was not a priority. Enhancement was, harvest transformation, or like the buying back of fishing vessels or aquaculture. These things have been prioritized, whereas salmon monitoring hasn't. So it's basically a lack of priority. I don't know if it's a lack of understanding of how important this basic information is. I can't see that being true. I think all salmon biologists recognize the need for information to assess the health of populations, but maybe the upper echelon of, you know, into the politics, they may not be interested in monitoring, interested in knowing how healthy salmon populations are, because they need to act on it. If they did know how healthy these populations are.
Mm-hmm. I noticed in part of the article, you're quoted as saying part of the solution would include strengthening Indigenous-led and community-based data collection. I was wondering if you could explain that a bit, what that would entail, what that would look like, essentially.
Well, it's starting to happen. It's been happening over the last number of years, probably kick-started with the wild salmon policy and the recognition that DFO can't do it alone. But also knowing, you know, given the remoteness of many salmon spawning streams on especially the central and north coast of British Columbia and into the Yukon, there are many Indigenous communities that reside in these remote areas, and they have been active stewards of this resource for thousands of years. So it's really a transferring back of that stewardship to local communities. So that has been happening, where local Indigenous communities are starting to, are doing some of that monitoring. They are going into salmon spawning streams and counting them. So it's more of that. It's transferring more of that stewardship to local Indigenous communities, allowing them, providing them the capacity to do that. And it does two things. One, it enables salmon to be monitored in some of the remote regions of our province. But two, it also provides capacity for often underemployed communities. So I feel there's a real missed opportunity beyond salmon conservation and turning the tide and ensuring that salmon populations don't decline and become extinct, which some are and some have. It's also empowering local communities to, again, be more active stewards and, you know, be that primary steward of the resource.
One other question I had was regarding the specific species of salmon that need monitoring and determining of where their health is at. One specific type of salmon in particular that was referenced was sockeye. And I'm wondering if there's any specific reason as to why the health or the data around the health of sockeye is something that is lacking in particular.
Well, it's interesting. Sockeye salmon have been, like, when commercial fisheries began in the late 1800s, sockeye were the primary species. Their red flesh was the first to be marketed. They could put it into cans. People recognized that. It actually took a while for pink salmon and chum salmon, who have much lighter flesh, to be accepted by the public and marketable. That didn't happen until the war years, when they literally needed to provide food for the troops. And so part of my PhD research used the scales from sockeye salmon dating back to the early 1900s. So in some ways, we have the most amount of information on sockeye salmon compared to all other species. But when it comes to monitoring, the challenge with sockeye is they're the one species that those spawning fish literally go back to the place of their birth. They, what we call, they don't often stray. They don't often go into other rivers that they were not born in to spawn. So they have very high genetic uniqueness. So almost, if you can think of it as every spawning stream has a genetically unique sockeye population. Whereas other species like chum salmon or Chinook salmon or pink salmon, these populations consist of, at times, hundreds of spawning populations. So because they stray so often, they have a lot of genetic mixing. So sockeye salmon actually have the most number of unique populations. They're actually called conservation units. It's a different level of population. So a sockeye conservation unit, again, may just have one spawning population, and there are some 200 of those, say, in the province. Whereas a given Chinook salmon conservation unit might consist of over 100 spawning populations. So it's much easier for us to, and this is the way, it was a conservative way that we assessed whether we have enough information on a given conservation unit. As long as one spawning population for Chinook within a conservation unit that may have hundreds of spawning populations, as long as one was counted, we said, check, you have enough information to assess its health. That's, you know, we could go into the weeds, which we didn't, about whether that's adequate or not. We don't. But that's why, for a lot of these sockeye conservation units, they're in very remote places that are admittedly difficult to monitor and count. And so it's actually, that's what, you know, kind of, if we say there's a lack of monitoring for sockeye salmon, That's why. Proportionately, that's not true. Really, they're about even across all species. It's not that we're targeting sockeye salmon and saying, let's not, you know, count those fish, because actually they still remain an economically, but also culturally important species. Like to First Nations, they're right there at the top. Chinook and sockeye for First Nations, particularly in the Skeena where I'm at with the Wet'suwet'en, those are the two species that elders wish for. You know, coho are not desired. So there is a priority to monitor them, but they're difficult and they're genetically unique. So there's a lot of them. So proportionally they're the least monitored.
I think I have one last question for you about this, which would be, with research studies such as the one that you helped write, as well as others that are studying similar things regarding the monitoring of West Coast salmon, do you have hope that that work is going to help influence things in the right direction?
Yes, of course I have hope. I mean, that's the primary reason for doing it. It's like you want to create change. You want to improve, excuse me, the situation. And, you know, one source of inspiration of hope is the, you know, what we call boots on the ground, the biologists, stock assessment biologists in particular. That's kind of a division within Fisheries and Oceans Canada. They're responsible for assessing, making sure we have the information required to assess populations. That is their desire, that they have more information. And unfortunately, that there again speaks to the priority of the department as a whole. And the department is responsible for shellfish and other marine fish. So they have a big portfolio, salmon only being one of them. But this stock assessment division has been receiving less and less money to do the necessary work. Well, I feel like, yeah, there are a lot of individuals that desire this change. And also, I think if we can make the case for these opportunities, these local stewardship opportunities for local communities to be more active stewards and monitors of salmon, I think that's the direction that we need to go. So yes, I have hope. I have hope, even though, you know, recent study. So I said about 50% of the populations, we really don't have the information to assess their health. Well, of the half that we do, roughly 70% are considered to be in decline. So salmon are in trouble. There's no doubt about that. But where I have hope is, you know, when we do give them a chance, when we do make informed decisions, they can rebound. Salmon are super resilient animals. So I think they'll be there in the future. It really just depends on our everyday decisions and whether they're in the best interest of salmon or not. So, yeah, I have hope for salmon. I have hope that this... you know, this is kind of like a report card. It's providing a report card to the department of where things are at when it comes to collecting the necessary information on salmon. And hopefully they'll respond positively. But I don't think this alone will do that. I think the public needs to, you know, we need to put as much pressure on the government as possible to create that change, whether it's for monitoring or whether it's for salmon conservation broadly or whether it's for, you know, the health of the natural world. It's really down to you and I, Danny, to put pressure on those that make these decisions.
Once again, that was our conversation on decreased monitoring of Pacific salmon populations with Michael Price, a conservation scientist and adjunct professor of biological sciences at Simon Fraser University. This has been Danny Nesvedarani, your community journalist for CJSF 90.1 FM. This segment would not have been possible without the continued support of the Community Radio Fund of Canada's Local Journalism Initiative. You can also find this piece on frequencynews.ca. All right, we are back with Speak Up only on CJSF 90.1 FM. This is Danny Nesvedarani once again, your community journalist, and I'm here live in studio now with a very special guest, Autumn Jean Cairns, a multidisciplinary artist and curator of Collective Disorder. Thank you so much for coming in today.
Thank you so much for having me. I've always had two dreams. One of them is to get to blow the horn on a train, and the other is to be on the air. So I finally achieved one of them.
Thank you for so much for coming up live. I know it can be a little weird getting up here up on Burnaby Mountain. But to start, why are you here? What are we here to talk about today?
Well, we're here because the 3-year anniversary show of Collective Disorder is coming up. It's called Disorder X because it's the 10th disorder show to happen at Redgate Art Society, and it's a beautiful and vibrant queer arts variety showcase that I'm so excited to be putting on, and so excited to be here talking about it with you.
Mm-hmm. First question I have is, give me background of Collective Disorder. How did it get started? What does it encapsulate?
Yeah, sure. Sure. So, the first disorder show was, about 3 years ago. I actually immigrated to Canada from the U.S. about 4 years ago. And when I got here, I went to school for art in Tallahassee, Florida. And there I really fell in love with performance art and all the different ways that you can be experimental on stage. And, you know, in my background, I had been a visual artist doing drawing and painting, which I still love. But there's something about the kind of visceral nature of performance art, of connecting with an audience live in person in a way that is experimental. It's not quite theater. It's not quite music, but it overlaps with all these things. And then when I moved here and I got really involved in the DIY music scene, and I was like, for one thing, this is queer as hell, and I love it. Just so many queer and trans folks in the city that are artistic and creative and enthusiastic. And I was meeting so many bands and going to so many shows, and I was like, I feel that the art that I practice and that I fell in love with in Florida, performance art, would be so amazing sharing a stage with this music, because there's a shared sense of like the kind of punk experimental, we're going our own way. So the first disorder show, my idea behind it was blending performance art and music. We had some experimental musicians, we had some performance art, and it's really just blossomed since there, where each subsequent show I've gotten to meet more and more people from different disciplines in the art scene, poets and comedians and actors and playwrights and clowns and drag queens. Like, the variety is incredible. And so my goal with Collective Disorder is to be a home for these live events that can bring people together in the community to share in all of this incredible diversity. There can be work that makes you laugh. There can be work that makes you cry. There can be work that makes you want to get up and dance or even mosh a little bit. And just like providing that sense of, there's a place where you can go as an artist and as an audience member to be seen and to share what you make and to have it shared with you. And it's, you know, it's one of the best things that I've ever found to be able to do that work.
That is so cool. I can't even, you know, I can't even be eloquent or professional right now. That's just very, very cool.
Aww.
And one thing I was curious about is,